content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. We're going to resume in Volume 63, Number 2, the Spring 2024 edition, It's Revolutionary, Choices in Conflict. And we'll start with the secondary winner of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine article contest, and that is Catherine Green, who, as a member of the Piedmont Patriot Historians, Piedmont Community Charter School in Gastonia, Matthew Richards' advisor, was the winner of the 2023 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine article contest, secondary division. In this article, there are several words to know, which is a sidebar to this. We'll define these terms now before reading the article. Liberty, the quality or state of being free. Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Strike, when many workers band together and stop working to protest something about their jobs, such as to demand better pay, hours, or working conditions. And ratification, the act of formally approving something. Her winning article was The Revolutionary War and Our Right to Protest. The Revolutionary Era was a critical time in American history. It was at this time that the concept of liberty was introduced to our nation. American citizens fought bravely and tirelessly to gain their independence from Britain, resulting in the rights and liberties that are still enjoyed today. At that time, colonists were faced with the daunting task of not allowing their newfound nation to take away the same rights they had fought desperately for. It was through protest and challenging our leaders that Americans were able to ratify the United States Bill of Rights in 1791, after the American Revolution. These rights that arose from our early national period have had a major influence on how modern-day American citizens are able to freely protest today. During the Revolutionary Era, assembly and protesting were ways to make sure that the voices of citizens were heard and the issues could be addressed. For example, Americans protested Britain's addition of a tax on tea by boycotting the British East India Company. This led to the very public act of throwing hundreds of chests of tea into the Boston Harbor. In North Carolina, the First Amendment was exercised heavily during the 1700s when the Regulator Movement was taking place. The movement earned its name because many North Carolinians thought it would be better to manage their own affairs instead of leaving it up to crooked officials. Colonists opposed the exorbitant taxes and government corruption being placed on them by refusing to pay these taxes and protesting against government officials. Another major protest in North Carolina was the Luray Mills strike in Gastonia. This strike happened in 1929 and protested terrible working conditions. Protesters were met with violence and brutality, yet they persevered. This is another example of people exercising the First Amendment right for the greater good. Assembly and protests have continued to be widely used throughout American history, from protesting to gain women's rights in the 1800s, assembling to promote religion during the Enlightenment period, to protesting to gain civil rights for African Americans in the 1960s. The collective power of a group fighting for what they believe has continually been a catalyst for change. A significant movement today is the Black Lives Matter movement, with its counterargument being Blue All Lives Matter. These movements have typically had very large assemblies and protests and truly find their power in numbers. Another example of protesting today is March for Our Lives. They are a youth-led movement to pass legislation to help end gun violence. Many members are victims of gun violence themselves and have used their First Amendment right to make change. They have actually been successful in getting legislation passed that supports their cause. A major step for the United States was the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. The freedom of assembly became a key part of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The First Amendment also protected the right to free speech and the freedom of the press. Even though early Americans had been performing these actions long before the passing of these documents, having official government protection of these rights was game-changing. Since these actions were now protected rights, colonists were able to speak their minds to an extent without fear of government retaliation or punishment. Our right to petition the government also arose from this period. Petitioning the government is essentially a formal way to ask the government to reevaluate or change a policy or to fix an issue. It can take many forms, including filing lawsuits, submitting complaints, circulating a document such as a referendum for others to sign, or more. People use their right to petition to continue to protest things such as unfair taxation. An example of a current petition is the Willow Project petition. The Willow Project would allow drilling to access petroleum in Alaska. While this would produce lots of oil, it could also devastate the environment. The goal of petitioning this is to stop the project before it happens. People from the revolutionary period and even before paved the way for us to have these rights today. Protesting, petitioning, and speaking your mind are now encouraged instead of criticized, as they have been in the past. Our protected rights are a privilege we have to thank from our revolutionary-era protesters, who through their efforts gave us the ability to speak out against injustices. Also included in this article is a quote of the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The next article is North Carolina Shows Up at the Constitutional Convention by Sally Causey Bloom, who writes, deletes, and writes some more on topics in history for the North Carolina Museum of History, where she also produces videos and live streaming. And it has a little sidebar about the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation made up the first Constitution of the United States and went into effect in March 1781. The 13 Articles provided each state with a great deal of power, while the Confederation, or central government, was fairly weak. The group governing the Confederation was called, aptly, the Confederation Congress. Recognizing the problems of the Articles of the Confederation, the Constitutional Convention was called for in 1787. And now here's the main article. The men you see on the opposite page represented North Carolina in a big way at an important time. Why should you know them? Because their choices could affect your life today. Over on the other side of the page that she's referring to are portraits of Hugh Williamson, Alexander Martin, William Blunt, Richard Dobbs Spaight, and William Richardson Davey. Did North Carolinians attend the Constitutional Convention? Yes. As the new United States struggled under the Articles of Confederation, with states wrangling about war pensions, territories, taxes, and trade, and the Confederation Congress basically powerless to intercede, many leaders knew a fix was needed. After fighting a war that concerned a government with too much power, unpopular taxes, and the advocacy of individual rights, many were concerned about calls for a stronger centralized power. When a convention was called to amend the Articles of Confederation, North Carolina's legislature participated reluctantly in choosing delegates to the Constitutional Convention. They waited to the last day of the session to elect delegates Governor Richard Caswell, William R. Davey, Willie Jones, Alexander Martin, and Richard Dobbs Spaight. Did these men participate in the convention? Not all of them. Willie Jones, who disagreed with the notion of a strong central government, refused the appointment. Governor Caswell was ill. He chose Hugh Williamson and William Blunt to replace himself and Jones. The final North Carolina, William Blunt, William R. Davey, Alexander Martin, Richard Dobbs Spaight, and Hugh Williamson, but only three of them would be signers of the document. How did North Carolina's delegates contribute to the convention? Differently. Read on to learn more about each man. William Blount, born 1749, died 1800, was from Bertie County and served in the Continental Army for part of the Revolutionary War. A member of a prosperous family, Blount was an enslaver of more than 20 people. After serving as a paymaster for the Army, Blount was a member of the state legislature and the Continental Congress. While the convention was meeting, Blount continued attending Congress. He noticed, "I was not present all the time the convention was debating and fixing the principles of the government." Blount did return for the signing of the Constitution, but reluctantly. Elected to the second state ratification convention, Blount was more enthusiastic, supporting and voting to ratify the North Carolina Constitution. A land speculator, Blount accumulated vast tracts in the land that became Tennessee. Appointed governor of the territory south of the River Ohio and superintendent of Indian Affairs, he relocated to Tennessee. He worked to make Tennessee a state and was elected one of its first senators. As his investments floundered, Blount apparently plotted to help the British win control of New Orleans. He was removed from the Senate, but remained a leader in the state he helped found. William Davy, born 1756, died 1820, was a boy when his family immigrated from England, settling near the border of North and South Carolina. Davy trained as a lawyer, and during the Revolution, he commanded cavalry units in those states. Later in the war, General Nathaniel Greene made Davy North Carolina's commissary general, in charge of finding food and supplies for the American Army. Davy railed against the lack of support, although he continued in the role until the war's end. Following the war, he and his family established their home in Halifax, where he eventually enslaved more than 100 persons. At the Constitutional Convention, Davy and the other North Carolina delegates helped pass the Connecticut Compromise, which provided for a Congress consisting of two houses, one with representatives determined by a state's population, and the other with two members for each state. Davy ardently spoke up for the inclusion of the enslaved population for determining representation, reminding the delegates that the convention would be at end if enslaved people were not counted, threatening the state's refusal to join a union without full agreement to the Three-Fifths Compromise. Davy returned to North Carolina before the Constitution was finished. He worked diligently for its ratification. While attending the state's second ratification convention, Davy proposed a bill to create the University of North Carolina, which passed. Davy later served as governor and as a commissioner to France. He relocated to South Carolina near the end of his life. Here's a sidebar about that compromise. Three-fifths? The Three-Fifths Compromise provision allowed for 3 out of 5 enslaved persons, or 60%, to count when determining representation and taxation. The intent with this language was to reinforce what all Southern states called for at the convention, the requirement that enslaved people be counted in some way to increase these states' power in the House of Representatives. Representatives would be determined by a state's population. Southern states, where larger numbers of enslaved people lived, benefited most from including the enslaved population in the official count for establishing the number of representatives to Congress. Giving Southern states more say in Congress was only harmful to enslaved people. Alexander Martin, born 1740, died 1807, was born in New Jersey but grew up in North Carolina's Guilford County. A lifelong public servant, he served in colonial offices and in the Continental Army. He was named commander of the 2nd Regiment of the North Carolina Continental Line. During the Battle of Germantown, Pennsylvania, in a thick fog, Colonel Martin and other Continentals mistook their own men as British soldiers and opened fire on their comrades. Following the battle, Martin was tried for cowardice and found innocent. He resigned his commission and was elected to the state's legislature and served as governor for several years. His political position was not staunchly Federalist. That group wanted a strong executive leader. He was pleased to inform Governor Caswell, "They, the delegates, are not about to create some king to rule this country." Martin, perhaps more concerned with matters at home, left the convention before its conclusion and did not sign the document. His public service continued as governor, a United States senator, and state legislator. He was an enslaver with a plantation, Danbury, in Rockingham County. Richard Dobbs Spaight, born 1758 to 1802, was from a prominent family in New Bern. Spaight studied abroad, returning to North Carolina in 1778. He quickly joined the state militia and fought at the Battle of Camden. Elected to the state legislature, he left the military, also serving in the Continental Congress. At the Constitutional Convention, Spaight made a proposal about how proposed measures would be considered that had a big impact. This procedural rule permitted a delegate to request reconsideration of a previously decided issue. In practice, the rule allowed delegates to proceed more informally and to work toward consensus. Spaight believed, "There is no man of reflection who has maturely considered what end must and will result from the weaknesses of our present federal government, but must sincerely wish for a strong and efficient national government." Spaight regularly attended the convention and signed the Constitution. Back home, he was a fierce advocate for its ratification. Following ratification, Spaight was elected governor and also focused on his properties, including management of lands and the work of dozens of enslaved persons. Spaight was elected to Congress. In 1800, John Stanley of New Bern defeated Spaight in his reelection campaign. The two men traded public verbal attacks that were so strident that a duel occurred between them on September 5, 1802. Spaight was shot and died. Hugh Williamson, born 1735, died 1819, was born in Pennsylvania. His studies in theology, medicine, and the sciences made him friends with Benjamin Franklin and a member of the American Philosophical Society. He witnessed the Boston Tea Party en route to London, where he appeared before the British Privy Council and warned of possible colonial rebellion. Britain's blockade of Boston meant that Williamson settled in Edenton. He was appointed Surgeon General of North Carolina's forces. He inoculated troops against the disease of smallpox and crossed enemy lines to help wounded British soldiers. Following the Revolution, Williamson served in the North Carolina General Assembly and the Continental Congress. He was a regular attendee and an active delegate to the Constitutional Convention, where he forcefully advocated for a strong national government, serving on five committees. And while Williamson was not an enslaver and personally opposed slavery, he supported the Three-Fifths Compromise, saying the Southern states could not be members of the Union if the clause should be rejected. After signing the Constitution, Williamson returned to North Carolina and worked for its ratification, giving a speech on Edenton's courthouse stairs. "I should describe it as more free and more perfect than any form of any government that has ever been adopted by a nation." Following ratification, Williamson served in Congress before moving to New York City, where he continued to research and write on various topics. What did it all mean? North Carolinians' contributions to the Constitution were significant if muted. Showing up, participating, and returning home to push for ratification helped institute a new form of government, a new nation. Of North Carolina's five delegates to the convention, three, Hugh Williamson, Richard Dobbs Spaight, and William Blunt, signed the document for North Carolina. All five insisted on including the Three-Fifths Clause, which, while providing for Southern states' participation in the Union, also helped maintain the institution of slavery that would not be addressed for another 70-some years. Here's the Think About It sidebar article. The beginning of this article asks, who were these men and why should you know them? You might joke, is it going to be on the test? Ha ha. Anyone can learn the facts about history, but ask yourself these questions. Why might it be important to learn about the people who made history? How can knowing more about these people help you understand what they did or did not do? Who might be missing? And how can you learn more about them? The next article is North Carolinians Debate the Constitution. This was written by Jason Stroud, who is a historian specializing in Revolutionary America and the early Republic, especially North Carolina, and has served as conceptual editor for this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian. He is assistant professor of history at Greensboro College. In 1788, James Iredell was worried. Iredell, a state judge, was one of many prominent North Carolinians who wanted this state to join others in ratifying or approving the Constitution written at the Philadelphia Convention in 1787. But, as he wrote his wife Hannah in August, North Carolina was out of the Union and God knows when we will get in again. What happened? The answer is, in 1788, Iredell and other Federalists, or supporters of ratification, were on the losing end of a historically important political struggle over the Constitution. The Constitution was a great achievement, but compiling the document was one thing. For it to actually go into effect, a new government had to be established. 9 of 13 states had to ratify the Constitution. And as men like Iredell found out, it was far from a sure thing. Soon after the Constitution was published, a fierce political debate kicked off between Federalist supporters and anti-Federalists who opposed it. People debated the document in public and in their households, but also in special conventions called by states to decide whether or not to approve it. Nowhere was the debate between the Federalists and the Antis, as they were known, more fiercely contested than in North Carolina. Many North Carolinians were very skeptical of the new Constitution. When the time came to elect delegates or people to represent them at the state's ratification convention in Hillsboro, North Carolinians voted overwhelmingly for anti-Federalists. Some of the elections were hard-fought, even violent, and the results show that most citizens were opposed. The Antis won a huge majority at Hillsboro. Why? Many small farmers from the state's western counties worried that the Constitution would put power in the hands of people far from North Carolina. In the 1700s, news could travel no faster than a horse, and New York City, the first U.S. capital, seemed very far away. So they argued that most political power should remain in the state, which Samuel Spencer, a leading anti-Federalist, described as the basis of our happiness, security, and prosperity. Many ordinary folks worried about the power to tax given to Congress in the Constitution. Others wanted a religious test that would guarantee that only Protestant Christians could serve in government. Still more feared that the Constitution gave too much power to the president. The Anti-Federalists faced formidable opposition from many of the state's leaders, mostly from the eastern counties. Men like Iredell and William R. Davy, a delegate to the Philadelphia Convention, were among the most vocal Federalist leaders. The new nation, they said, would fail without a stronger central government. They observed that by 1787, the weak national government couldn't even enforce its own laws or raise money through taxation. Many actually feared that some state governments were too democratic. They didn't trust the will of ordinary people. They thought only wealthy people should make the decisions. And they hoped the Constitution would restrain democracy. North Carolina's ratification convention met in July of 1788. It was scorching hot in Hillsboro, but almost 300 delegates crammed into St. Matthew's Church to debate the new Constitution. The outnumbered Federalists did most of the talking, but didn't change any minds. After several days, the convention did something extraordinary. They voted not to ratify the document. But they didn't reject it either, which left hope that it might be ratified soon. The Antis also got another outcome they wanted. Like some other conventions, the Hillsboro Convention proposed changes known as amendments, and the addition of a declaration or a list of rights to the Constitution. These alterations reflected anti-Federalist concerns, and without them, North Carolina would not ratify. Some of the rights they listed might sound familiar, including protections against unreasonable searches and seizures of personal property, excessive bail, and cruel and unusual punishments. The right of citizens to keep and bear arms in a well-regulated militia was also protected, as were free speech and free exercise of religion. In the spring of 1789, the new United States government formed with George Washington as president. 11 states sent representatives to Congress but North Carolina did not, since it had not ratified the Constitution. But soon after the new Congress first met, Representative James Madison proposed several amendments to the Constitution. They included many of the protections demanded by the Anti-Federalists. With these amendments proposed, the North Carolina legislature called a new ratifying convention, this time in Fayetteville, in November 1789. In Fayetteville, the Federalists won, and the convention overwhelmingly voted to join the new nation. In the end, Congress added 10 amendments, together known as the Bill of Rights. These amendments established the civil liberties intended to protect all Americans. The Anti-Federalists may have lost their struggle with the Federalists, but the Bill of Rights is an important outcome of their efforts. Here are captions accompanying the photographs that are in this article. One shows a copy of the Constitution of the United States, and next to it a copy of the adoption and ratification of the United States Constitution by the state of North Carolina. Highlighted in the Constitution's copy is, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." There is also James Iredell, 1751, was born and died in 1799, a North Carolinian from Edenton, who was one of the most vocal supporters of the Constitution. And there's also a picture of the inauguration of George Washington as first U.S. president at Federal Hall, New York, 1789. It's an engraving of Federal Hall. Next is the last article from the issue, from the editor, "What Do You Think?" by the editor, Kathy East. You might have heard the word centennial. That means a 100th anniversary or celebration of something. Or bicentennial, which means a 200th anniversary or celebration. But have you ever heard the word semiquincentennial? Well, get ready, you're going to. It's a big word to say, but it's easy to break down and read it slowly. Semiquincentennial. Might take a little practice, but now I can say it, and so can you. This word means the 250th anniversary of something or its celebration, and you'll find it in the name of the United States Semiquincentennial Commission. On July 4th, 2026, our nation will commemorate a very special moment in our history. The U.S. Semiquincentennial Commission was established by Congress and signed into law by former President Barack Obama to start planning the 250th anniversary of founding of the United States, otherwise known as the 4th of July, our birthday. The commission is charged with orchestrating the largest and most inclusive anniversary observance in our nation's history. So let's go. We hope this issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian, Its Revolutionary Choices and Conflict, will help jumpstart your exploration of the American Revolution and North Carolina's special role in that story. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.